Stay safe on the roads with Rain-X Vision Beam Wiper Blades. Now at Menards. For over 40 years, Rain-X has provided drivers with products to outsmart the elements. Their Vision Beam Wiper Blades are easy to install and are designed to provide a smooth, streak-free wipe every time. Save big money on all Rain-X products now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We're here again to sift through the sources, pull out those really compelling insights, and hopefully uncover some surprising facts that leave you feeling genuinely well-informed.
Exactly. And today, we're serving up a really in-depth look at an athlete whose impact was just undeniable, both on the court and, frankly, off it, too, with that electrifying personality.
Absolutely. Think about this for a second.
Yeah.
A tennis player whose serve wasn't just fast, it was like an absolute cannon, a genuine force of nature, regularly hitting, you know, a jaw-dropping 155 miles per hour.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of power, you could just leave opponents stunned.
Right.
Ribs frozen. Mm. And the crowds. They went wild for it. It was pure awe.
But you hit on something key there earlier. It wasn't just about the raw power, was it? That serve became his, like, definitive calling card. It was the physical embodiment of a player who really, truly ignited American tennis during his time.
Totally. His whole approach to the game, the competitive fire, just everything. It left a mark that went way beyond just a stat sheet. It was a real statement every time he stepped up to that line.
A statement indeed. So today, our mission is to peel back the layers on Andrew Steven Roddick, born August 30, 1982, Omaha, Nebraska. And, of course, a longtime Austin, Texas guy. He was just so much more than a great athlete.
Yeah, he really was. He captivated fans, didn't he? Not just with the, you know, the amazing tennis, but with that compelling personality.
Yeah.
Sometimes fiery, yeah, but always kind of authentic.
Yeah.
Kind of must-watch TV.
For sure. And this deep dive, it's not just going to be a summary. We want it to be your shortcut to really understanding the nuances of his journey.
Right. So in this deep dive, you're going to get the full picture. Roddick's journey from, well, a young, determined kid who actually almost walked away from tennis.
Can you imagine?
I know. All the way to becoming a Grand Slam champion, world number one. We'll break down his unique playing style that serve, obviously, and really get into those intense rivalries that, you know, often defined his career.
And crucially, we'll also take a look into his life off the court, which is pretty fascinating in itself, right? His post-retirement stuff.
Well, yeah, surprisingly diverse. And we'll consider his legacy in tennis and, well, beyond. So get ready for some surprising facts, engaging insights.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get a perspective that goes way deeper than the headlines.
Okay, let's unpack this. Start right at the beginning. Andy Roddick's story kicks off in, you might say, fairly humble origins. Omaha, Nebraska. Youngest son of Blanche, a school teacher, and Jerry Roddick, a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
But here's something that might surprise you, something really interesting. He wasn't the first tennis talent in the Roddick household, not by a long shot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he had two older brothers, Lawrence and John. Both were promising players themselves when they were young. So you can almost see this, like, family predisposition for the sport baked in from the start.
That makes a lot of sense. It's pretty common in elite sports, isn't it?
Yeah.
That kind of environment fosters competitiveness, early exposure to the, you know, the discipline involved.
Right.
And for Andy, that family influence was clearly huge. The family lived in Austin, Texas during his really formative years, like ages 4 to 11. But then came this really pivotal move for the family, and kind of inadvertently for Andy's whole career, they moved to Boca Raton, Florida.
Ah, the tennis hotspot.
Exactly. What? It wasn't just a change of scenery. It was a calculated move driven by his older brother John's tennis ambitions. Put them right in the middle of this, you know, renowned hotbed for junior tennis.
The perfect crucible, really.
Totally. Well, that environment, packed with talent, top coaches, it was perfect for Andy's developing skills. He went to SE Boca Prep International School, known for accommodating young athletes, right?
Right.
And even did high school online.
So flexibility was key.
Absolutely. Allowed him to really dedicate himself to the intense training, the demanding competition schedule.
So his brother's career sort of inadvertently set Andy on his own path, but wow, it wasn't always a smooth ride, was it?
Not at all.
There's this crucial turning point, and it really says a lot about his character, something many people probably don't know. At 17, Roddick actually considered quitting competitive tennis.
Wow, 17.
Yeah. Can you believe it? He was stuck in this really frustrating losing streak in the juniors, had this massive crisis of confidence, pushed him right to the edge of walking away.
Yeah, intense.
But his coach then, Tarek Benhabiles, who worked with him from 99 to 2003, he stepped in. Benhabiles saw something, you know, that raw talent, that drive underneath the frustration.
Right.
And he persuaded him. He said, give tennis 4 more months of undivided attention. Just 4 more months. Talk about a make or break moment, a real crossroads.
It's fascinating, isn't it, what that early crisis tells us about Roddick's character and, you know, the sheer mental strength you need for elite sports.
Absolutely.
It's actually incredibly common. You know, promising athletes, late teens especially, facing these moments of just profound doubt. The pressure, the grind, physical, mental, the travel, those inevitable losing streaks, it can be so disheartening.
It leads to burnout, right? Or just losing the passion.
Exactly. And for Roddick, this wasn't just a slump. It was a full-on crisis. Made him question everything. Benhabiles stepping in. That wasn't just tactics, was it? It was about reigniting that spark, that love for the game that, you know, hadn't quite gone out.
Yeah.
And that period, it undoubtedly forged a tougher, more determined player. Taught him how to push through adversity. A lesson that, well, served him pretty well later on, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. It tapped into this hidden resilience.
Yeah. And once he tapped into it, boom.
And what a turnaround. After almost quitting that moment of real vulnerability, his rise to junior dominance was, well, incredibly fast. Spectacular, really.
Mm-hmm.
In 1999, he finished as the number 6 junior in the U.S. Impressive, right? But then, 2000, he just exploded onto the international scene, grabbed the number 1 junior spot in the world.
Huge leap.
It wasn't just a good year. It was dominant. Showed he'd found his rhythm, his belief. He racked up, get this, 6 world junior singles titles and 7 world junior doubles titles.
Wow. That raw talent Benhabiles saw was undeniable now.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he bagged 2 junior Grand Slam titles, the U.S. Open and the Australian Open singles, both in that crucial year, 2000.
Both of them, okay.
Clearly, that 4 more months advice paid off big time. He was ready for the pros. He even got his first ATP-level wins that year against guys like Fernando Vicente and Fabrice Santoro, seasoned pros.
Those weren't just wins then, they were previews. Glimpses of the firepower about to be unleashed.
Exactly. That rapid climb from nearly quitting to world number 1 junior, it really shows a player who found his stride, but maybe more importantly, found his belief again.
Yeah. Having tasted that defeat, nearly walking away, it probably gave him a new perspective, you know, a deeper resolve once he recommitted.
Makes sense.
And those junior wins weren't just numerous. They were against the best young players globally. Showed he had the skills, the mental toughness, even before officially turning pro. It was like total domination. Hinted at what was coming.
Which sets the stage perfectly for him jumping into the big leagues. Roddick officially turned pro in 2000, and he didn't exactly hang around waiting to make an impact.
No kidding.
At just 18, in 2001, he showed that huge promise with some truly stunning wins. And these weren't just, you know, wins against mid-level guys. These were statements. Against legends, top-ranked players, announced his arrival loud and clear.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep.
His immediate impact was, well, pretty remarkable. Created a genuine buzz around this young American kid.
Yeah.
I mean, think about this moment. 3rd round, Miami Masters. He faces and beats Pete Sampras. 7-time Wimbledon champ, world number 4 at the time.
At 18?
Right. For an 18-year-old, that's not just a win. It's like symbolic. Passing the torch, almost. Showed his fearless approach against one of the greats.
That wasn't all right.
No way. Later that same year, August, he takes down the then world number 1 Gustavo Kuerten.
Muga, wow.
These weren't flukes. There were clear signs he belonged right at the top.
Ah.
Stepping onto court with his confidence that just, you know, defied his age.
And it wasn't just hard courts either. At the 2001 French Open, not traditionally his best surface, he battled Michael Chang, a French Open champ himself, in this grueling 5-setter in the 2nd round. And won. Showed his grit on clay.
Mm-hmm.
Then at Wimbledon, a surface he'd later, well, almost master. He showed that early potential. Took a set off the eventual winner, Goran Ivanovic.
Right. Goran. That was a Goran's year.
So these weren't just ticks in the win column. They were massive statements, weren't they? They established him really fast as this versatile force, someone you had to reckon with on any surface, challenging the old guard.
Precisely. These early wins, they were about announcing his arrival with this, like, resounding declaration. Beating Sampras, Kuerten, Chang in his rookie pro year, sent a clear message, Andy Roddick is here. And he's not afraid.
Yeah.
And for you, the listener, just imagine the excitement back then, that surge of hope for American tennis, this young, powerful player emerging, capable of going toe-to-toe with the best right out of the gate.
Laid the groundwork.
Absolutely. Laid the crucial groundwork for his reputation. Formidable. Fearless. Set the stage for that steady climb leading to that consistent presence in the top tier by 2002.
And that consistency, that's really a defining feature of his career, isn't it? A testament to his relentless hard work.
Totally.
His overall pro record, 612 wins, 213 losses. That's a fantastic 74.2% win rate and 32 career singles titles. That's a serious haul.
It really is.
But what really gets me, what underscores that sustained excellence, is that incredible run, ranked in the year-end top 10 for 9 straight years, 2002 to 2010.
9 years.
That's not just a good year or two. That's almost a decade at the absolute peak. A relentless pursuit of excellence few can match.
That kind of consistency is just so rare in tennis. It's such a demanding sport, physically, mentally, injuries, younger guys always coming up.
Yeah.
So those early wins against the top guys, they weren't just flashes in the pan.
Yeah.
They showed his ability to compete and win at the highest level consistently. Set the stage for a career defined by sustained excellence.
It's not just winning once.
Exactly. It's doing it week in, week out, year after year. That speaks volumes about his work ethic, his adaptability, his competitive spirit. To stay top 10 for nearly a decade means he was constantly tweaking his game, pushing himself, overcoming challenges.
And all that hard work, that talent, that grit, it all came together in one defining year, 2003.
Ah, 2003.
The season of triumphs for Andy Roddick, the year he really hit his peak. Everything just clicked.
It really did.
Started with that absolute marathon at the Australian Open. Quarterfinals against Younes Elanoi. They battled for 5 grueling hours.
Oh, I remember that match. Unbelievable.
Epic display of endurance, power, mental toughness. Roddick won eventually. The fifth set alone went 21-19.
21-19. At the time, that was the longest fifth set in a slam in the Open era.
Just imagine the sheer physical and mental toll, the deep well he had to dig into just to keep going point after point after point. Mm-hmm. It was a statement. Talented, yes, but also unbreakable.
That match wasn't just a win, was it? It was a statement about his tenacity, his refusal to quit, that burgeoning mental toughness. It was like a crucible forging in even further. Set the tone for the whole year.
Yeah.
After a bit of a dip at the French Open, he found his rhythm again on grass. Big time. Won Queen's Club in the UK.
Right, Queens. Huge prep for Wimbledon.
And beat Andre Agassi, world number 2 then, in the final. In a final set tiebreak.
Yeah.
Showed his adaptability, his readiness for the biggest stages.
And he just kept rolling, didn't he? Dominated the Masters Series events.
Yeah.
Bagged his first 2 Masters titles back to back.
Yep. Montreal beating Nalbandian. Then Cincinnati beating Marty Fish.
Fellow American.
Right. These are massive tournaments just below the slams. Winning 2 like that showed he was in peak form, brimming with confidence, heading into the U.S. Open.
He is.
Home slam.
And then the U.S. Open breakthrough. The moment he'd been building towards.
Mm.
Semifinals were another epic. Rallied from 2 sets down, saved a match point against Nalbandian again.
That Nalbandian match. Just incredible drama. Defines careers, moments like that. Where sheer will just overcomes impossible odds.
To come back from 2 sets down and save a match point in a slam semi speaks volumes about his self-belief, his clutch performance under extreme pressure.
Absolutely. And he carried that momentum, that confidence, right into the final. Hmm. Delivered this decisive victory over Juan Carlos Ferrero, who was number 3 in the world then. Straight sets.
His only Grand Slam singles title.
It wasn't just a win. It was a statement. Domination that season, the culmination of all that hard work, all that resilience.
And with that iconic U.S. Open trophy, Roddick officially hit world number 1, November 3rd, 2003.
Number 1.
Held it and finished the year as the year-end number 1. The historical significance here, especially for American tennis, it's huge.
Massive.
First American to finish number 1 since Agassi in 99, and the youngest American to hold that rank since computer ranking started back in 73, monumental for U.S. tennis. Restored that sense of dominance.
And looking at it psychologically, tactically, his peak in 2003 was this powerful mix of things clicking.
Yeah.
First, his unique skills that serve. The forehand they were just firing, the serve was practically unreturnable for so many guys. Gave him a huge edge-holding serve, put massive pressure on opponents.
Right.
Tactically, he'd matured a lot, not just raw power anymore. He was constructing points better, using variety, angles, picking his moments to attack.
Smarter tennis.
Exactly. And those grueling matches, like against Elanoi, showed a big psychological shift. that unyielding mental toughness, ability to push through, stay focused, obvious in that U.S. Open semi-comeback.
So is the whole package coming together?
Totally. Refined skill, tactical smarts, unwavering mental strength. That's what took him from almost quitting to number one, a journey of self-discovery, mastering his game.
It's truly incredible then, isn't it? After such a stellar career-defining year, his reign at number one was actually pretty short.
Yeah, relatively speaking.
Just a few months later, February 2004, this new force, Roger Federer, hits number one after winning his first Australian Open.
Enter Federer.
And that, of course, kicks off the iconic Federer-Roddick rivalry, a rivalry that was, well, let's be honest, heavily skewed.
Yeah, the head-to-head wasn't pretty for Andy.
Despite his own talent, his consistency, Roddick only beat Federer three times in official ATP matches his whole career.
It's almost the defining narrative for Roddick, isn't it? That Federer rivalry, this constant shadow, a classic case of an incredible player running into maybe the greatest of his generation.
It's timing.
But, you know, the lopsided record, it actually highlights Roddick's own excellence. He was the one always reaching those finals, constantly facing Federer.
Good point. He was consistently there.
Exactly. It wasn't that Roddick wasn't amazing. It was that Federer was just an anomaly, operating on another level. Roddick was consistently the second best player for long stretches. That's a huge achievement in itself.
And nowhere was that clearer and maybe more heartbreaking than on the grass at Wimbledon. Became the site of some of Roddick's most valiant yet ultimately crushing losses.
Oh, Wimbledon. The green grass of defeat for him against Roger.
His first final there, 2004, four-set loss to defending champ Federer. The very next year, 2005, same story. Second straight Wimbledon, final loss to Federer.
Deja vu.
But the match that stands out, etched into tennis history, the one that just broke hearts everywhere, the epic 2009 Wimbledon final.
Oh, the 2009 final. That wasn't just a match. It was an odyssey, wasn't it? A five-set marathon, testing the absolute limits.
It went on forever.
And that final set, 16-14 to Federer, 16-14. The tension was just unbearable. Every single point felt huge.
And Roddick, even though he lost, set records that day. Records that speak volumes about his fight. Won 39 games in a slam final. The match itself. Longest men's slam final ever, 77 games. Longest fifth set in a men's slam final.
Brutal, beautiful tennis from both guys. Showed their incredible athleticism, mental strength. It was the pinnacle of the rivalry, really. Even in defeat for Roddick.
And the quote that came out of it, when he was asked about his marathon effort. Famously short, poignant, almost heartbreaking. I lost.
Yeah, I lost. Said it all, didn't it? Cut through all the stats, the records, the what-ifs, just the raw truth of sport.
So for you, the listener, how do these defining losses, especially 2009, shape how we see Roddick's legacy? What does it say about his resilience, his determination, that he kept pushing Federer so hard, even in defeat?
It's paradoxical, really. On one hand, they highlight the immense challenge he faced in an era dominated by maybe the GOAT, a guy who just had all the answers.
Right.
But on the other hand, his sheer resilience in pushing Federer to those limits, it actually elevates him, doesn't it?
Mm.
Turns those losses into a kind of triumph of spirit.
Yeah, I see that.
Speaks to profound mental strength.
Yeah.
Refusal to be totally beaten, even when the score said otherwise. That I lost, quote. Not just resignation. It was acknowledging the brutal reality of pro sports. No excuses. Humanizes him. Shows even champs have moments where their absolute best isn't quite enough.
Tough lesson.
For someone striving for perfection. Yeah. A stark reminder of how cruel top-level competition can be.
And the story of losing to Federer in major finals wasn't just Wimbledon, was it?
No, unfortunately not.
He also lost to him in the 2006 U.S. Open final. Just further underscores Federer's dominance in those huge career-defining matches. Felt like no matter what Roddick did, how well he played, Federer was always there, this insurmountable wall.
It's spot on. That consistent Federer wall in slam finals definitely impacted Roddick's career, his mental game, hugely. There's that undeniable what could have been, right, if Federer wasn't around.
Yeah, I have to wonder.
Roddick was clearly slam caliber, won the U.S. Open, always top 10. But imagine if he faced someone else in those other four slam finals he lost. The whole narrative might be different.
Very different.
Psychologically, it must have been incredibly tough. Reaching the final hurdle, knowing Federer is likely waiting. But that constant challenge probably forced Roddick to keep refining his game, push his own limits, made him more complete, even if the biggest prizes often slipped away.
Shows his persistence.
Absolutely. His intellectual curiosity about his own game, even facing what seemed like an unbeatable opponent sometimes. Makes you think, doesn't it? How much is an athlete's legacy shaped by their rivals, not just their own wins?
It's a great question. So moving beyond those intense slam battles, let's look at the other sides of Roddick's career. The consistency, the constant search for improvement through coaching changes, the wins in team events, paints a broader picture.
Yeah, truly dedicated athlete.
Speaking of coaching, his journey through different coaches is pretty interesting. Shows that relentless pursuit of an edge. Started with Tarek Benhebules, right? 99 to 2003. Junior and early pro years.
Mm-hmm. The guy who talked him out of quitting.
Then Brad Gilbert, known for strategy, unconventional methods, with him for about 18 months before Roddick fired him in 2004.
Tough decision.
Then Dean Goldfein, briefly with Jimmy Connors, who resigned in 2008. Then his own brother, John Roddick. And finally, Larry Stefanke from late 2008 till he retired.
Quite the lineup of experienced mentors, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Each one likely brought a different philosophy, a different focus.
Right. Benhabis for development, the turnaround, Gilbert for strategy, maybe capitalizing on the serve forehand.
Yeah, matchup-based stuff. But firing him suggests Roddick was always seeking something more, right?
Mm.
A sharper edge, different perspective, maybe a connection that wasn't quite there.
Them Connors, legendary competitor, trying to inject that fire.
Exactly. That relentless spirit, aggressive baseline play,
mm.
clear attempt to bring in that championship mentality. Then turning to his brother, and later Stefanke, who was known for refining established players, fixing weaknesses.
Shows that constant search.
Totally. Reflects his constant, almost obsessive search for tactical tweaks, technical improvements,
mm-hmm.
especially with Federer and Nadal rising. Shows his ambition, his smart approach to the game, his commitment to maximizing every bit of potential.
And that relentless drive paid off. Despite the tough slam losses, Federer's shadow, Roddick's consistency was just remarkable.
Truly was.
9 straight years in the year-end top 10, 2002, 2010. That's not just winning a few big ones. It's maintaining that elite level week after week, year after year. Monumental feat.
Navigating injuries, pressure, new opponents.
Yeah. Plus 5 Masters titles. Those are huge tournaments outside the slams. Montreal, Cincy in 03, Miami 04, Cincy again 06, Miami again 2010. Shows he could win major titles consistently even when slams were tough.
And don't forget that ATP record, 18 consecutive tiebreaks, won in 2007.
Oh, yeah. That's astonishing. Highlights his composure, execution under pressure, tactical smarts when it's down to the wire.
Tiebreaks are mental battles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Winning 18 straight speaks volumes about his psychological strength.
Yeah.
Ability to deliver when stakes were highest. Huge weapon.
Speaking of triumphs showing a different side, Davis Cup. He was pivotal in the U.S. winning the 2007 title, their first since 95.
Massive win for the U.S. team trophy resonates differently.
And Roddick was central. Clinched a key singles win against Tursunov in the final. His Davis Cup record, generally, incredible. Went 12-0 in clinching matches for the U.S.
12-0.
Clearly loved playing for his country, thrived in that team setting.
That Davis Cup record really shows another dimension, doesn't it? Performing for your nation, especially in those high-stakes clinchers. It's about team spirit, national pride, elevating your game for the group.
Yeah.
Roddick clearly thrived there. Showed leadership, resolve when the U.S. needed him, powerful part of his legacy, often overshadowed by the individual slam chase.
Now, let's talk about a moment that just transcends tennis. A real act of sportsmanship that defines his character for me.
Ah, the Verdasco match.
Yes, 2005 Rome Masters. Roddick versus Verdasco. Match point for Roddick. Verdasco serving second serve. Linesman calls it out. Match over. Roddick wins. Or should have.
Right.
But Roddick motions to the umpire, points to the clear ball mark on the clay, says, no, the ball was in.
Wow. On match point.
Call gets changed. Verdasco mm-hmm. wins the point and ends up winning the match. Roddick upheld the game's integrity at his own direct cost. For you, the listener, this isn't just tennis. It's a legendary example of integrity. Fair play. Resonates way beyond the court. Character, pure and simple.
It's absolutely legendary. Speaks volumes. In a sport where every point counts, careers are built on winning. To voluntarily give up match point, potentially the match, for fairness, incredibly rare.
Yeah.
It's a moment that, for many, defines Roddick's moral compass more than any trophy. Prioritizing integrity over victory, it embodies the best of athletic spirit. Reminds us there are values higher than just winning. Roddick chose the harder, more honorable path there. Huge respect for the game itself.
And while he was doing all this winning, showing sportsmanship, he was also battling injuries. Lots of them. Testament to his grit that he stayed so consistent despite it all.
Yeah, the list is long.
Foot injury, 06 French Open. Hamstring issues, 07. Shoulder and neck problems, 08. Yeah. Left knee injury, 09, tough for movement. Mono diagnosis in 2010, saps your energy. Oblique tear in 2011, hitting that serve. Ouch.
Those recurring injuries definitely impacted his game. His ranking likely played a big role in his retirement decision.
Can't you?
For a player relying on explosive power, that serve.
Yeah.
Any setback to the shoulder, knee, core compromises his biggest weapons. Imagine the frustration knowing your body's holding you back.
Mentally draining, too.
Totally. His perseverance through all that shows immense grit, stubborn commitment, pushing through pain, endless rehab, adapting training, highlights his determination to stay at the top despite his body screaming otherwise. Common battle for elite athletes.
Beyond the court, beyond injuries, he also made a big statement with his activism, a moment that resonated widely.
Right, Dubai.
Yeah, 2009. He chose not to defend his Dubai title, a big tournament, $2 million prize. Why? To protest the UAE refusing Israeli player Shahar Peer a visa.
Bold move.
He just said, simply, powerfully, I really didn't agree with what went on over there. For you, the listener, this is a powerful example. Athlete taking a stand on a political human rights issue. At significant personal cost money, ranking points, title defense. Walked away on principle.
That protest was incredibly impactful. Speaks volumes about his character. In an age where athletes often get told stick to sports, Roddick took a very public, financially costly stand.
Yeah.
Showed deep commitment to his values beyond the game.
Mm.
Some principles outweighed personal gain or career. It wasn't just talk. It was action with real consequences.
Yeah.
Earned respect far beyond tennis. Cemented his reputation as someone willing to stand up for what's right, even when it's tough or unpopular. Used his platform.
Okay, when you think Andy Roddick, you immediately think...
The serve.
That serve.
Yeah.
The defining characteristic of his style, weapon of mass disruption, a force opponents just had to deal with. Renowned for sheer power, 130, 150 mile a mile consistently, 209, 242 kilometers, often just unreturnable, not just speed, precision demolition.
And historically fast, right? He held the world record for a bit, 155 mile a mile, 249 kilometer, hit during Davis Cup in 2004, Karlovic broke it later, but still shows the explosive force.
Holds the U.S. Open record, too. 150 millimeter row.
To see that live, the ball just blurring across the net, an experience.
And not just one-offs. He consistently hit blazing speeds everywhere. 148 Aussie Open, 150 Dubai, San Jose, 151 Madrid, Washington, 153 at Queens, 143 Wimbledon. It was a refined strategy, too. Targeted the corners for aces, force guessing, constant threat.
And the second serve wasn't a puffball either.
No way. Heavy kick serve. Used spins, slices, angles to keep guys off balance. Heavy topspin on both serves made them jump. That high kicking twist serve was nasty, often tied up returners.
What's fascinating is how that serve didn't just define his game, but arguably a whole era. Influenced players coming after him.
How so?
Forced opponents to rethink returns, right?
Uh-huh.
Standing way back just to get a racket on it.
Yep.
And it wasn't just speed. It was placement, spin, variety, hard to read. He knew how to leverage it tactically, free points, setting up easy forehands, forcing errors.
Stroke power.
Exactly. And strategically, while serve forehand dominated, he worked hard to become more all court, went from aggressive baseliner to mixing it up more. Occasional serve and volley surprises, even if mostly stayed back. Showed willingness to adapt, grow. Critical with Federer and Nadal rising.
He also had that other favorite, the off forehand. Used it tons early on, then maybe more strategically later to open the court.
Yeah, huge weapon.
But we should acknowledge, and he would too, the backhand was seen as a relative weakness, right? Often targeted.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely yeah. The side opponents went after more.
But under Larry Steffanke in 2009, even that got better. What kind of changes did Steffanke bring? How did that help?
That's a great point. Shows his dedication again. Steffanke often focused on simplifying the motion, consistency, depth over trying to hit winners. Subtle tweaks, grip, prep, footwork to handle pace better, direct the ball, especially cross court.
Less risky.
Right. And using the slice backhand more strategically. Change pace, disrupt rhythm, not just hit flat. Didn't turn it into a massive weapon, but made it way more reliable, less of a liability.
Made them less predictable.
Exactly. Harder to exploit. Forced opponents to work harder. His evolution made him more complete, despite the serve forehand dominance. Adapted to the changing game, knew you needed more tools against the big three. Beyond the court, Roddick was hugely marketable. Became a public figure, recognized everywhere, transcended the sport.
Totally.
Got that nickname A-Rod, playful nod to Alex Rodriguez. Even did that funny This Is SportsCenter ad confronting the anchors for not calling him A-Rod. Showed his humor, willingness to play along.
Perfect blend of athlete and entertainer, and his marketability. Underscored his appeal beyond just tennis wins. Brand saw him as engaging, outspoken, charismatic, authentic American athlete. Grit, humor, relatable charm. Resonated with people.
Which explains the huge endorsement deals. Reebok early on.
2000 to 2005.
And then that massive Lacoste deal in 2005. 5 years, $25 million plus eyewear. They even did an Andy Roddick collection later. Shows his status with them.
Big time deal. Testament to his star power.
And the list goes on. Lexus, Amex, Rolex, Powerade, Parlux fragrances, Arizona Iced Tea, Xbox, Sega. Impressive portfolio. What made him so attractive to all these different brands? More than just the serve, right? He connected.
Definitely more. Potent combo. On-court power, outspoken charisma. Accessible, funny, showed passion, even the outbursts, while maybe controversial, showed raw emotion, fire.
Relatable in a way.
Yeah. Blend of fierce competitor and approachable, witty guy, compelling figure, embodied that all-American ideal with a modern, media-savvy vibe, weren't afraid to be himself.
Right.
Authenticity was key.
And his presence wasn't just endorsements. He went from court to camera smoothly, lots of media appearances, guest starred on Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
Ah, yeah, 2002. Classic bit of pop culture for an athlete.
Frequent guest on talk shows, Letterman, Conan, Leno, Ellen, Kimmel, Regis, and Kelly. Showed his quick wit, charm, embraced the celebrity side easily.
And the biggest media moment, arguably, hosting Saturday Night Live in 2003.
Huge.
Only the second tennis player ever, first male tennis player.
Yeah.
Significant milestone, shows crossover appeal, comedic timing. Then the cameo and just go with it, with his wife, Brooklyn Decker.
Right. The Adam Sandler movie.
And even that men's fitness cover controversy. Quipping, Nadal wanted his arms back. Hilarious. Self-deprecating, poking fun at himself and the sport.
He had that wit, but also that fiery edge. Sometimes came out as those memorable on-court outbursts against officials.
Oh, yeah. Definitely had a reputation for those. Added that unpredictable, raw energy.
2001 U.S. Open, calling the ump a moron, got a code violation, showed his temper early.
Mm.
2008 Aussie Open, that famous line to umpire Emmanuel Joseph. You're an idiot. Stay in school, kids, or you'll end up being an umpire. Ouch. Tennis fans remember those.
They sure do. Other moments, too. Losing it at the 2010 Aussie Open over a call. Later admitted he was wrong, which is interesting.
Show us some reflection.
Yeah. Kyrie over a footfall at the 2010 U.S. Open. Penalty point for ball abuse. 2011 Cincinnati led to a break. More arguments.
So that blend of intense focus, competitive fire, occasional tantrums shaped public perception, right? Was it passion or a distraction?
Probably both.
Yeah.
Made him more polarizing, maybe, but undeniably captivating. Showed a raw, unfiltered humanity. Resonating with fans, even if it got him in trouble.
He cared intensely.
Exactly. Outbursts were often just that deep desire to win bubbling over. Frustration when things felt unfair or went wrong. Added human drama few others had.
Like all great careers, his time on tour had to end. Emotional announcement, right? On his 30th birthday, August 30th, 2012, said he'd retire after the U.S. Open, his home slam.
Yeah, poignant timing.
And a big reason. Wanted to focus on his work with the Andy Roddick Foundation. Says a lot about his priorities shifting, doesn't it? From personal glory to philanthropic impact, telling transition.
His final match. A tough fourth-round loss to Del Potro, September 5th, 2012. End of an era. Right. Then, just days later, honored in Arthur Ashe Stadium where he won his slam. Andre Agassi was there.
Fitting tribute. Passing the torch.
Ended that year ranked 39, lowest since turning pro. Shows the toll, the startful timing of his exit. He knew when it was time.
But retirement from tennis definitely didn't mean retiring from public life. Far from it. Embarked on this multi-talented path, especially media and broadcasting. His wit, personality really shone there.
Immediately transitioned, yeah.
Yeah.
Co-hosted a radio show with Bobby Bones, Fox Sports Radio. Hinted at making it full-time. Then Fox Sports 1 TV gig in 2013, co-hosting Fox Sports Live.
Joined the BBC for Wimbledon commentary in 2015, too. Insightful analysis.
And in classic Roddick fashion, got a temporary gig with Tennis Channel in 2020 after apparently tweeting them, asking for a job.
Love that.
And now, 2024... launched his own weekly podcast, served with Andy Roddick for Tennis Channel. He really found multiple successful ventures in media, leveraged his knowledge, unique personality perfectly.
He certainly did, and it shows his versatility, enduring appeal. But his interests weren't just media, explored other sports too. Still loves competing.
Right. Played his first pro golf tournament as an amateur at the Pebble Beach Pro-Am in 2013. Showed his athleticism crosses over.
And pickleball.
Yeah.
2023 Million Dollar Pickleball Slam on ESPN with Chang, Agassi, McEnroe. Shows his love for competition, trying new things, staying active in sports, just differently.
And critically, maybe defining his post-tennis life most. Yeah. His deep dedication to philanthropy.
A huge part of his story.
Got the Arthur Ashe Humanitarian Award in 2004 for tsunami relief UNICEF work and founding his own Andy Roddick Foundation for at-risk youth. then the Arthur Ashe Institute for Urban Health Award in 2007, first male tennis player to get it.
Mm.
That's a massive, unwavering commitment to making a difference, a legacy beyond titles.
His dedication to the foundation, his charity work, it reflects a different, arguably more profound success beyond just athletic wins. It's about giving back. Using his platform for good speaks volumes about his values.
But Foundation does great work, right? Out of school time for kids.
Yeah, providing critical academic enrichment opportunities can genuinely change lives for at-risk youth. And personally, he had that high-profile relationship with Mandy Moore earlier.
Right.
But later met his wife, model actress Brooklyn Decker, after seeing her on a CNN Sports Illustrated site. Agents connected them, dated from 2007, married 2009 in Austin.
Built a family life.
Yeah, two kids now. Son born 2015, daughter 2017. Life away from the tour grind.
And here's that truly surprising, almost philosophical tidbit about his career perspective. Brooklyn Decker revealed it in 2017. Roddick got rid of most of his tennis trophies, kept only the U.S. Open one.
Only the U.S. Open trophy.
The reasoning. According to her, he said simply, these don't mean success to me.
Wow. That's profound, isn't it? Startling, coming from a slam champ who chased those things his whole life.
It
challenges our whole idea of achievement.
It really does. What does that say about him?
It's incredibly telling. It speaks volumes about his unique perspective. Suggests that for him, the measure wasn't the physical hardware, the silverware, but maybe the journey, the challenge, personal growth, connections, impact.
Internal versus external success.
Exactly. Redefined success internally. Highlights his unpretentious nature, too. Motivations were beyond just collecting trophies, maybe the pursuit of excellence, joy of competition, satisfaction of overcoming challenges. And of course, despite his personal view on trophies, his career was formally recognized. 2017, inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame.
Alongside Kim Clijsters. Well-deserved.
Yep.
Solidifies his place in history, undeniable.
Absolutely.
So we've journeyed through this dynamic, often dramatic, always compelling career of Andy Roddick, from that power-serving kid who almost quit, to Grand Slam champ, world number one, consistent top player, and this distinctive personality leaving his mark on and off court. This deep dive showed you the grit, the glory, the heartbreaks against a legend, and those surprisingly human moments defined an American icon.
Yeah, and his impact really goes beyond the titles, doesn't it? It's in that unyielding competitiveness, that fiery temperament that made him so captivating, his huge humanitarian efforts with the foundation, and those diverse post-retirement ventures. He represents a pivotal era of American tennis, bridging generations, and still engages the public in new ways, always on his own terms.
So considering Roddick's revelation about the trophies, this don't mean success to me. What does that suggest about the true measure of achievement for people who reach the absolute top? Is it the external symbols or the internal journey, growth, impact?
Makes you think.
And for you, the listener, what physical or emotional trophies do you value most from your own achievements? And why? Something powerful to ponder as you go about your day.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope you feel a little more well-informed and hopefully entertained too.
Until next time.